this organization was engaged in a major scheme to defraud the Internal Revenue Service and the United States Treasury.
Federal authorities say they've unraveled a massive tax fraud and identity theft operation. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, July 19th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, wind turbines go up on Fire Island near Anchorage.
I can see the power for, hundreds of households in this when starts those blades to turning.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska, and by First National Bank Alaska, offering business solutions to help Alaska's dreams grow for 90 years. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC.
Federal prosecutors in Anchorage today announced 77 indictments in a massive tax fraud case involving identity theft and cocaine smuggling. Last December in Philadelphia, a man flying from Anchorage was arrested while trying to take $50,000 cash out of the country. Joel Jose Santana Pierna was among five people charged the next month with cocaine smuggling. He was in the country illegally, as were most of his co-conspirators. Today, the government announced superseding indictments of those five and six others, including one U.S. citizen for identity theft and numerous other tax fraud charges. U.S. Attorney Karen Loeffler said it was an elaborate scheme involving the stolen identities of 2,600 residents of Puerto Rico. Those identities were used to set up fake bank accounts and to file fake reports of income with the Internal Revenue Service. The addresses used were those of existing people in Anchorage and Eagle River. The suspects then filed claims for tax refunds, and they intercepted the checks from 25 to 30 mailboxes.
In some instances, what they would do, the scheme alleges, is would go to an actual address, get a real address, and then put a fake name on it, and have the refund come, and then they would take the mail before it ever got to the individual that actually lived there.
The indictment lists $19 million in attempted fraud, but some of those claims were caught before they were ever paid. Loeffler said the actual amount taken has not been totaled up, but it is in the millions. The fake identities were found on computers seized as evidence as the cocaine case was investigated by police and the Drug Enforcement Administration.
This case started out as a narcotics trafficking case led by DEA and the Anchorage Police Department. What happened is we determined, the law enforcement agencies determined that in addition to narcotics trafficking, this organization was engaged in a major scheme to defraud the Internal Revenue Service and the United States Treasury.
The case exploded to involve many agencies, customs officials, the Internal Revenue Service, Homeland Security, the postal inspectors, and law enforcement personnel in several states. Seven suspects are in custody, two are still being sought, and two are being served with orders to appear in court and answer charges. Among the 11, the sole U.S. citizen is Fatima Aguilar Martinez, a former officer at Wells Fargo Bank in Anchorage.
The indictment alleges that she was helping to participate in this case by allowing people that she knew to file, basically open multiple, the same person to open multiple bank accounts under different names.
All the suspects have multiple aliases, along with addresses and bank accounts. They had multiple driver's license under different stolen identities. Apparently, what made the tax fraud scheme possible was the theft of identities in Puerto Rico, where most residents don't have to pay federal income tax unless they are employed in the United States. Anchorage's new wind farm is set to go online by the end of September. When completed, the project, which is being developed by Cook Inlet Region Incorporated, will provide enough electricity to power 4,000 homes along the rail belt. The transmission line that runs across the inlet is almost done, and this week crews are hoisting the first of 11 wind turbines into place. KSKA's Daisha Eaton visited Fire Island and has the story.
If you've been on the downtown waterfront lately, you may have seen in the distance the cranes working across the mudflats on Fire Island. At high tide, the only way to get there is by plane. Just a few miles across the bay, the island comes into sight, hillier and bigger than it appears from the opposite shore, covered in cottonwood, black spruce, and Devil's Club. Before the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, the island belonged to the military. Now Siri owns most of the island. Today, five giant cranes move along its web of gravel roads, lifting giant pieces of wind machines into place. Workers have already used the cranes to install the bases for 11 turbines that will provide the first source of renewable power to Alaska's largest city. When the blades are up, the wind machines are more than 100 feet taller than the ConocoPhillips building, the tallest building in Anchorage. Each wind machine takes about 2 months to erect. Scott McManus is supervising this phase of the project.
Kind of like Lincoln Logs. You just piece them together, bolt them together, tension and torque the bolts, and go to the next one.
McManus is with Tetra Tech, a New York-based company that specializes in building wind farms in the lower 48 and Canada. On Wednesday, around 100 workers were on the island. Officials say the majority of them are Alaskans. Construction has gone smoothly, except for occasional visits from bear and moose. When the turbines get spinning, they'll provide about 4% of the region's power. That's not a lot, but it's a start, says Margie Brown, president and CEO of Siri.
We are striving to become an independent power producer with traditional energy resources, but also alternative and renewable energy resources, not only here in Alaska, but in the lower 48. And so this is going to be a kind of a signature piece for our growing portfolio of energy projects in our subsidiary, Siri Energy.
Siri is partnering with Chugach Electric on the project. Chugach surveyed south-central Alaska for potential wind sites in the 90s and identified Fire Island as the best spot because of strong, consistent winds blowing up Turnagain Arm. The winds blow strongest during the winter months, when south-central uses the most power, and let up when our power use is lowest in the summer months. Former legislator Harry Crawford stands below one of the giant turbines looking up. He doesn't just see a wind machine.
I can see the power for, you know, hundreds of households in this when starts those blades to turning. I can see it. I can feel it. It's just not quite here yet, but it's coming.
Crawford is now a member of the board of directors at Chugach Electric. He says the wind farm on Fire Island is an important first step in stabilizing energy costs along the rail belt.
As time goes by, we'll pay for these towers, and it'll be much cheaper power. As the cost of gas continues to go up.
The towers and on-island infrastructure cost about $65 million to build, according to Siri officials. Right now, Chugach power costs on average 6 cents per kilowatt hour. Most of that comes from natural gas. At the start, the wind power will be 3.7 cents more. But with gas prices expected to rise, alternative energy advocates say in the long run, it will be a money saver.
Even though people may say it's only 4% of Chugach's power, it's a really important hedge against natural gas prices going up.
That's Chris Rose with the Renewable Energy Alaska Project. He says Fire Island Wind Farm opens the door to other such projects in the region that could further diversify the power grid.
Siri, as an independent power producer, is really the first IPP, as they're called, to operate in the rail belt grid. And so I think it also is opening up more competition in the rail belt for other companies to come in and produce renewable energy.
And Rose says for those that are worried about the possibility of the turbines impacting birds, that's not likely to be a problem. The farm is out of the flyway of migratory birds. The state supplied a $25 million grant to help pay for the power line, which Siri will eventually hand over to Chugach Electric. Construction was supplemented by a $17 million federal stimulus grant. Siri has permits to build 30 of the wind turbines, but is starting with 11. They should be feeding into South Central's power grid by fall. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Alaska Native leaders are in Washington urging lawmakers to pass climate change legislation. As APRN's Peter Granitz reports, some believe that's the best way to get federal money for relocating several villages.
There is no one central government agency to assist villages aiming to move because of climate change. Leaders in Kivalina, Newtok, and Shishmaref deal with a whole host of state and federal agencies, from the Environmental Protection Agency to the Army Corps of Engineers to the Department of Commerce. And that gets difficult. Yupik Nation Chief Mike Williams says the effects of climate change are too severe for the government to delay time by duplicating services or making plans and then failing to act.
Federal agencies need to be coordinated, and I think hearing on this matter in Alaska would help in consultation with the federally recognized tribes that live on the ground.
Williams says having oversight hearings in Alaska will force federal agencies like the EPA, which is legally required to consult tribes on policy decisions, to actually see how dire the situation is. And the Yupik Nation needs money to move villages. Williams says that he's pushing Congress to pass legislation that would allocate the money. And he has a straightforward pitch.
It's a disaster, and people are suffering.
Still, that may not be enough to sway Congress. The money would likely be attached to climate change legislation, something not only politically toxic, but also not scheduled for any votes. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Kenai fishermen struggle with the record low king run.
You know, it's going to really be bad for the local economy if we get wiped off the map.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. Providence Imaging Center with Drs. Scott Nespinski and Christopher Reed, providing interpretations of imaging studies with a focus on musculoskeletal radiology. PROVImaging.com. And by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the Trans-Alaska Pipeline with over 700 employees.
The Navy has just launched a new effort to track down unexploded ordnance in the waters near Kiska, Kodiak, and Unalaska. As KUCB's Lauren Rosenthal reports, they might want to start with the crew of the fishing vessel Aleutian Sable.
By the time he pulled up the mine, Jimmy Berg had caught as much metal as fish. Berg is a deckhand on the Aleutian Sable, and he was hauling black cod pots just outside Unalaska one day in late June. He had already found a 35-millimeter shell in his pot, so he wasn't particularly surprised when he spotted this thing stuck to another pot a few hours later. It was a hunk of rust, the size and color of a brick. It seemed harmless enough until it shocked him.
It shocked me, like, three times. But it looked, it looked pretty cool. So I just set it right between my legs as we kept hauling gear and smashing pots against the side of the boat.
During a lull, the crew started playing around with Berg's find. He handed it over to another deckhand, Dan Stickney, who left the Marines 2 years ago.
Then I handed it to him as Cameron started cutting it open with a knife, and we found out it was a bomb. And then he ran around the deck, scared. Now the Marine is scared because he has a bomb in his hand.
The bomb appears to be a World War II landmine. I sent a picture of it to Grady May, a Navy researcher, for confirmation. Here's what he could tell me for sure.
Yeah, you should never collect that. If you ever come across something that you don't know what it is, you should leave it alone.
Leaving it alone is exactly what the Navy's done in Kodiak, Kiska, and Unalaska for the last 70 years. But it's trying to remedy that now. May is in charge of a new program to find and catalog unexploded World War II ordnance in Alaska. With the help of contractors, he's asking residents and fishermen, like the Aleutian Sable crew, for information about where the ordnance might be. The Aleutian Sable's captain, Jay Hebert, pitched in his 2 cents.
Just throw a rock. You'll land on some. It's everywhere. I mean, Kiska, when I was out at Kiska last course, that was years ago, but there was ordnance everywhere. I mean, they just walked away, crashed airplanes, sunk ships, you know, torpedoes, bombs. They dropped bombs. Some of the bombs didn't go off. Well, don't dig them out or anything in the world. Let's just kind of leave them, because who's ever going to go to Kiska again other than us, like dumb fishermen?
Hebert's not too far from the truth, but that's not how the Navy would put it. May says the Navy prioritized areas where people were coming into contact with unexploded ordnance on a regular basis, on land and in developed and populated areas. They're still keeping those limits in mind. May says his search will only cover nearshore target areas that the Navy used during the war.
We find a lot of scrap in ranges and target areas. We find where the bombs exploded, the shells explode. We find a lot of that. And then about 10% of what we find, or less, are live.
It's that unexploded ordnance the Navy's looking for now. It's not clear how much is still here and whether it poses a risk to the public on land or at sea.
When you pick them up, it could detonate. But most of the time, especially in water munitions, they're mush and they probably are fairly inert, but you just don't know.
The Aleutian Sable's captain, Hebert, isn't sure if it's a safety risk either. Hebert's been fishing near Unalaska for 34 years, and in that time, he's collected plenty of ordnance. He's even developed his own strategy for making sure it's safe.
I have a bunch of that I've taken down, and I leave it on the boat to dry for about 6 months, then I put it out in my garage and let it dry for a year or two, and I figure if it doesn't blow up by then, it's not going to blow up.
That's the basic plan for the Aleutian Sable's bomb. Berg, the deckhand, says that the Aleutian Sable has been doing really well since he pulled it up. He thinks it should stay on the ship, as a good luck charm. They've agreed to keep a landmine on the bow for the next 6 months to let it dry out. Hebert says he wonders if the government won't come for it first.
This bomb, I don't know. I'm just waiting, you know, for the FBI or Homeland Security or someone to come, you know, and it's like they're going to confiscate it from us, you know, for national security reasons or whatever. So I don't know, but if they don't steal it from us, we'll take it home, and it's like put it in the display case next to the rest of the junk, the trinkets and doodads from the ocean.
At the very least, May, the researcher, promises that he's not after the Aleutian Sable's good luck charm. His goal is to learn more about the caches of ordnance the Navy left behind and start figuring out if they need to be cleaned up. May says the Navy probably wouldn't come for the fisherman's bomb either. After 70 years in the sea, most ordnance is considered abandoned property. That means it belongs to whoever finds it and dares to keep it. In Unalaska, I'm Lauren Rosenthal.
As in many parts of the state, so far 2012 has been a rough year for fishing on the Kenai Peninsula. Despite a healthy run of sockeye salmon to the Kenai River, king salmon fishing was shut down completely this week. As KDLL's Shaylin Cochran reports, the slow season is beginning to take its toll, and not just on the sport fishermen.
This year has seen dramatically low returns of king salmon, not only to the Kenai River and others on the peninsula, but across the state. The recent closure of all king salmon sport fishing on the Kenai is something not seen in decades, says Kenai River Sport Fishing Association Executive Director Ricky Geese.
In the last 30 years, yes, this is unprecedented to have the in-river king salmon fishery closed down and the Eastside Setnet fishery closed down.
At approximately the halfway point of the season here, just a shade over 4,000 kinks have passed through sonar counters. The minimum escapement goal for 2012 is 17,800 fish. The problem of low abundance touches not just the sport fishing community, but commercial fisheries as well.
Right now, our crews are sitting on the beach, and we're bleeding money.
That's Melissa Hall.
We have 13 people sitting on the beach doing nothing now. Feeding them. We've done every single home improvement project we can do in our camps, and we're trying to make the best of it. We have a very positive-minded crew, but, you know, every day they don't fish. They're not making money.
Melissa is an Eastside Setnetter. They've only been allowed to fish for 3 days this season despite healthy sockeye runs. She was gathered with other setnetters along Kay Beach Road between Kenai and Soldotna in front of the Department of Fish and Game offices, where she says they met with fisheries managers for over an hour. Their big concern? Well, with so few kings in the river, they don't see why their fishery is still off limits.
One set of numbers don't match up with the next set of numbers, which don't match up with the next set, so it just leaves you feeling a little confused and a little disoriented on why we're not out there fishing, when really there's nothing to prove that we're doing more or less damage than any other fishing user group.
While the low abundance of kings is a primary concern to the fishing industry, Geese says that's just one part of the equation.
Definitely the economic ripples of this closure are going to be felt throughout the community. We have retail businesses, we have lodges, we have restaurants.
And those are just the immediate local effects.
This is a statewide phenomenon. Every major fishery where there's a harvest on king salmon has been affected. The last few years, and especially this year, we're seeing unprecedented closures across the whole state that's affecting subsistence, personal use, commercial and sport users.
I spoke with another set netter, Tim Osmar, who says the goal now is to go beyond the local offices of Fish and Game and push for policy changes among the State Board of Fisheries and the Governor's Office.
And they claim that they can't do anything about it, so we're hoping to make enough noise and get the Governor and the Commissioner of Fish and Game down here to realize what's going on with the, you know, it's going to really be bad for the local economy if we get wiped off the map.
Geese says his organization will also be lobbying for the Board of Fisheries to take up the issue as soon as possible, adding that it is a statewide issue.
The fish come first, and you want to maintain that there's a healthy, at least meet the minimum escapement so you have sustainability for the future. But if there's a harvestable surplus, even though it may be small, how do you best extend opportunity on a social, recreational, economic basis for different user groups?
And though the problem of low king returns is statewide and affects multiple industries, the problem for people like Tim Osmar is simple.
We haven't made any money, and it looks like we're not going to.
From Kenai, I'm Shaylin Cochran.
Governor Sean Parnell is holding a press conference tomorrow morning to address the issue of low salmon runs affecting Alaskans across the state.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for nearly 60 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. CrowleyAlaska.com.
Alaska Housing Finance Corporation offers loans tailored for first-time home buyers, plus home choice education seminars that can help determine if a mortgage would be less than rent. There's more information at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by Alaska Housing Finance Corporation.
A resolution may be near for a dispute between the tribe in Sand Point and Penn Air. Last month, the company issued a letter restricting several tribal members from flying, shipping cargo, or even entering the terminal. Penn Air is the only commercial carrier that services the remote Aleutian Island community. Penn Air offers the quickest and most reasonable way off and on the island, and residents have felt stuck. APRN's Wendy Johnson reports.
Penn Air rents a terminal from the Chogan-Tiagunan tribe in Sand Point on the Aleutian Islands. Back in January of 2001, the tribe attempted to collect back rent, utilities, and other charges associated with the lease. After a year and a half of negotiating, bickering, and attempts to compromise and settle the dispute out of court, Tiffany Jackson, executive director of the Chogan-Tiagunan tribe, says they were left with no choice but to sue Penn Air. When the lawsuit was filed, Penn Air retaliated by posting a list of 15 community members banned from the terminal.
I'm not sure how they identified the people named in the letter. I'm assuming they went to the tribe's website and just picked the names they found.
The only other way off the island is to take an expensive charter plane, to take a very long ferry ride, or to wait for the Alaskan Maritime Highway, which only serves them every 2 weeks. With no other legitimate way to leave, Jackson, who's also banned from the terminal, says that a number of concerns quickly arose.
A concern for me personally, I have small children, and they're not on this list of banned people, but I was. So what happens if one of my small children got ill and needed to go to a doctor in Anchorage? I couldn't take them.
Jackson says that one community member had to take a 5-day ferry trip to Anchorage to assist family with a medical emergency after Penn Air banned her from flying. She says that one tribal member was turned away when he went to the terminal to greet incoming family members. Others were denied access to cargo planes, which affected their businesses and the economy of the community. Also, the tribe is in charge of collecting data on shellfish to protect their community and surrounding communities from paralytic shellfish poisoning.
Our environmental coordinator did go down and ask if she could get them shipped since it was an issue of community health, and she was told no.
As of this week, Jackson has gotten wind that Penn Air took down the no-fly list. Representatives from Penn Air said that the matter was resolving itself, but wouldn't comment further. Still, Jackson is hopeful that this dispute can end.
Hopefully, now that the letter has been withdrawn, we can get back to a positive, healthy relationship between the people and the community, and hopefully this division that's been created can kind of heal.
The lawsuit pertaining to back rent and other charges that Penn Air owes the tribe is still pending. In Anchorage, I'm Wendy Johnson.
The 52nd annual World Eskimo Indian Olympics, known as WIO, is underway in Fairbanks this weekend. KUAC's Emily Schwing has more.
A short, round wooden dowel lies on the floor in front of Sam Strange. He's the head official at this year's World Eskimo Indian Olympics. He just finished explaining the rules for the toe kick. There's also a long piece of white tape stretched out in front of him. It's marked with 4-inch increments. When they begin, athletes swing their arms and jump forward.
So they must tap the stick with both feet, and it must roll backwards first, just a quarter inch or even a ton, it doesn't matter.
Most of the games at WIO originate from Native Alaskan survival skills. Christian Paul of Kipnuk says this event requires focus. He closes his eyes relaxes his shoulders, and...
I'm clearing my mind and relaxing. I haven't been practicing lately, but it's just something about clearing your mind that just makes it easier.
24-year-old Nick Hansen seems to have the toe kick down.
Well, I got first place, and I tied the world record, so that's pretty awesome.
Hansen is from Unalakleet. He didn't train for WIO this year, but he says he did help a friend get in shape for the games.
That's what it's all about. You go out there and you just have fun together, and that's why we're here. We're not here for world records. We're not here for getting as far as, well, personal bests, I suppose, but mostly just to have fun and hang out with good people.
Athletes come from all over the state of Alaska. For the second year in a row, a team from Greenland was invited. Gerd Muller is 34. He's no stranger to events like this, having participated in the Arctic Winter Games in Canada twice. He grew up taking part in the Inuit and Dene Games in Greenland. But there's one event at WIO that has him worried.
My weight is 110 kilos, and the other ones is only 75 kilos. I will try what I can do.
It's called Drop the Bomb. Muller prefers to call it airplane.
We got cargo freight coming in.
He lies on the floor, belly down, arms outstretched. Three men lift him, two by his wrists and one by his ankles. Later, 50 men, all wearing gloves, gather around a huge, round blanket made of seal skins. But no one is sleeping under this blanket. One, two, three, yells one of the men in Inupiaq, and up goes a tiny, rusty-haired woman.
My name is Caitlin Pickett-Bowl. The very, very first time I was on the blanket, I looked down and I screamed. But the second time they threw me up, I looked up and I pointed to the stars and I said, throw me up higher, throw me up higher.
And that's what the World Eskimo Indian Olympics is all about. Connecting with old traditions and gathering for a new adventure each year. In Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
The World Eskimo Indian Olympics continue through Saturday night at the Carlson Center in downtown Fairbanks. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Daisha Eaton in Anchorage, Lauren Rosenthal in Unalaska, Shaylin Cochran in Kenai, and Emily Schwing in Fairbanks. APRN's Peter Granitz reported from Washington, D.C., and Steve Heimel and Wendy Jonathan from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Meridian Management, specializing in coordination and management of all phases of construction projects from vision to completion, working to ensure that your project is on time and on budget. More at meridianak.com. The Rasmussen Foundation Sabbatical Program offers nonprofit executives and tribal leaders paid time away from their jobs for personal renewal and growth, and organizations often become stronger as a result. October 1st is the deadline to apply. Learn more at rasmussen.org. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation. As long as there are veterans, the Benevolent and Protective Order of Elks will never forget them. Throughout the year, Elks members in your community lend a hand, donate money, and volunteer time. It's not something they feel they have to do, it's something they want to do. Join with America's veterans in saluting the efforts of your local Elks Lodge. Information at elks.org. Elks care, Elks share. This message sponsored by the Alaska State Elks Association.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.